Meeting will come to order. Welcome, members. It's right at 8:30, and we have session today, so we're going to try to go through things judiciously and quickly. We have allocated about an hour of time for the Board of Water and Soil Resources, and then we do have a bill up today that we would like to move through. Just on that bill, there will be an author's amendment that apparently didn't get in the packet, so members, that will be coming and will be out on the table for the audience as well. Ms. Clocker, welcome to the committee, and maybe we're anxious to hear what the Board of Water and Soil Resources has done and plans on doing.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for having us here today. We are reporting on our FY08-09 budget outcomes, and as we've been working through this process, budgeting for results, it's kind of influenced how we think about what we do, and I think that's been a really good exercise for us. That being said, our reporting for our LGUs for many of the projects that we have implemented is not really completed until 1 year. The first year won't be until the end of this month, and then obviously 2009 will be further off. So we can report on our efforts and our goals, but we can't really report yet on the performance of how they've done with some of our programs. But, you know, we know that this is a process that will take several months, and as we get more data back to us, we will be happy to continue to report. So what I'm going to do is just take you through some examples of some of the outcomes and indicators that we have that meet our goals. And I'm going to start first by giving you just an outline of my presentation today. We're going to go over the mission, our organizational structure, our local delivery model, goals, how we're doing on our budget outcomes so far, and then what was the overall budget. Our agency organization, we have a 17-member board, and that board is representative of local governments, citizens, and state agencies. They are appointed by Governor Pawlenty, and they really bring a lot of reality to what it is that we do at the Board of Water and Soil Resources, since we are working with local government units. We have about 75 staff and 8 offices. About half of our staff is located in St. Paul. The rest of them are distributed throughout the state. And we are linked to about 240-something LGUs who implement the programs. A lot of our programs we don't do ourselves. We really rely on that local delivery model. And it's a balance between what we need to do at the state and applying that at the local level with local talents, local interests, and local resource issues.
Ms. Clocker, on the 75 staff, are those full-time equivalents? And could you maybe give us some context of comparison of, say, to 2 to 4 years ago, how many staff you had?
4 years ago, we actually have less full-time equivalents than we did 4 years ago. We have about 59 that are paid out of our general fund. The others are paid for with fees, contracts, grants, things like that.
So today you have more staff than you had 4 years ago?
No, we have less staff now than we did 4 years ago.
Okay. Proceed.
Our agency mission is to improve and protect Minnesota's soil and water and soil resources, and we do that by working in partnership with local organizations and private landowners. So what we really care about is the water and soil of the state, and how we get the work that we need to get done is through that local delivery model. Kind of just to summarize all of those points concisely, we have a very large local delivery system. We are a small agency with experienced staff, and really what we try to do is be a catalyst for them to get the work done out in the field. Altogether, there's about 450 individuals in that local delivery system. And again, we try to balance the local resource needs with what the state objectives are. We also are very successful in leveraging those federal and state dollars, federal and local dollars, again, being that catalyst. Our agency goals, we have 7 of them. The top 2 really embrace our overall mission, and that is to protect and improve water and soil resources and maintain that efficient and effective local delivery system. The others are really the supporting pieces for those two overall agency goals. We want to evaluate the effectiveness of our conservation programs, improve management of public drainage systems, ensure the long-term integrity of the state's investment, expand our technical knowledge and capacity, and be able to meet any increased trends or needs, such as we're having right now with carbon sequestration and other kinds of upcoming issues. And then the last one is critical, and that's really to provide some transparent accountability for all of our outcomes as well as those of our LGUs, and communicate how we're doing on our performance to those conservation goals. So what I'm going to do, and everybody has also a spreadsheet, and this is kind of how we started laying out all of those goals, the programs that support those goals, and we started working through some indicators for those goals. So I'm going to do an example, an overview of the goal, and then an example of indicator of that a program and indicator for that supports that goal. The majority of our efforts are obviously in our first two goals. The one is doing the actual on-the-ground implementation. So those supporting programs and activities are cost share, clean water legacy, feedlot water quality grants, non-point engineering, and all of those are grants that we funnel through our LGUs. Our Reinvest in Minnesota program right now is focused on wetlands and restoring wetlands throughout the state. We implement the Wetland Conservation Act. We, as part of that, also maintain the state's wetland banking system. And part of all of these is making sure that we are doing a good job of targeting and prioritizing where we invest those dollars. An example is our cost share program, and that was established to implement conservation projects throughout the state. The eligible entities are SWCDs. Our funding for this biennium it was 3.285 in 2008, and it was reduced slightly in 2009. One of our example indicators is the percent used of funding for projects. SWCDs are allowed to use some of this money for technical assistance, their actual effort going out and designing the project, working with the landowner, and then inspecting the project as it gets installed. But we want to make sure that the dollars that actually go to the project are the majority of the use of these funds. So our target for that is 80%. Reporting back several years, it takes, like I said, several years for our LGUs to use that money and then report on how they use that money. They do have several years of the cost share funding to implement it on the ground. So when we look at, this would be for 2007, we had a target of 80% of those monies used for the actual project. 58 of the counties met that target. One of them was given a low productivity rating, and that means anything under 59% used for on-the-ground implementation. It's important that you know that we have an impact to that. We don't just look at their productivity, but we actually use that measure to either reward those that have done very well with those dollars, or there are penalties if you aren't using those dollars for projects as efficiently as we would see. So in their last years of spending, there were a number of it resulted in about no productivity increase for six counties, even that were met that 80% target, because they had irregularities in how they ran the program, and then there were penalties for not doing the program administratively responsible, and that resulted in about $5,000 worth of penalties as well. So we do our best here to make sure that the money is being utilized well, and that if we reward those that are doing a good job with that.
Ms. Clocker, is that a reimbursement system so that it goes out to the local districts, they vote on a contract, and then the landowner provides receipts for the goods and services that were purchased, and then they receive the dollars?
Yes. It is a we provide the money to the SWCDs up front. And then as they go through and select their grant recipients, it goes through the board approval process. They only receive the money after they have submitted their final paperwork and receipts for that project. It is not upfront project dollars. Although there are cases where, because of construction season delays, maybe a project gets started in October, maybe there's weather issues that we don't want somebody who's doing a $60,000 project to have to carry that over the winter. So there are opportunities with board approval to provide some of that funding to carry them over until they can finish the construction.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. I understand the funding used for the projects, and your target is 80%. What's the 20% or actually 20 or more percent used on?
Ms. Glocker.
Chair and Representative Wagenius, that 20% is used for the technical assistance effort that the SWCD employee or staff member needs to go out there and design the project, work with the landowner, do site surveys, implement the project, and review the construction. So for every dollar that we put out there, we do know that about 20 cents of every dollar does need to go to that technical assistance to make sure that the project is installed correctly and designed well.
Just a follow-up. So all of that would be accounted for by technical assistance?
The 20%, that, yes, exactly.
Okay, that's fine.
Thank you. Another example of the way that we meet goal number one to protect and improve the water and soil resources of the state is for a wetland banking program. This was established in 1991, and its purpose is to mitigate the impact of wetlands that have gone through the WACA process, Wetland Conservation Act process. And the funding for that is through fees, through bonding, and through contracts that we have with MnDOT. An example indicator of this is our plus and minus bank balances. Really, it is just like a bank, and we look at credits that are established in each one of these bank service areas. The map that you see there, the bold black lines, are the bank service areas that the Corps of Engineers has, and we need to maintain the overall bank service area plus minus balance. We want it to be obviously to the good so that there are plenty of credits available as road authorities are doing their projects. But we also have a tighter restriction or goal there, and that is that we want to make sure that there's availability on a watershed basis, not just on a bank service area basis. So the Corps has their own requirements, and we put a little bit more stringent requirements or goal on that. Our target is to have a net gain. As of right now, we have not met that target. We aren't in the hole, but we would like to see more credits available. However, we anticipated that in 2008 and 2009, we would have very constrained resources for bank credits just because of how long it takes to go through the process. We have to go through the LGU approval process just like every other private banker, wetland banker, and it does take years for us to establish these. We do anticipate that at this time next year there will be a net gain in credits available for road projects. Another example of how we obtain our objective goal one is through targeting. And this is something that we're going to continue to get better at. This example is one that's currently hoped to be funded by the LCCMR, and I believe that it will be. The governor is working on signing an authorization to use emerging issues account dollars in order to fund this project. But what it's really looking at here is where are those expiring CRP acres in the state right now, and looking at that with soil productivity index, crop productivity index, so that we can get down to a very micro-targeting level to look at those that have a lower crop productivity index, so it's not really good for agricultural production, and we target those so that we can make sure that that federal investment that has come here and is already in protection remains in protection. So we are going to be implementing this in the next year, assuming that all the funding lines up as it should be. And then what we need to do is go out and market that and work with our LGUs to use this as they're going through their targeting of their local dollars, be it cost share or clean water funding or whatever it may be. Our goal, too, is to maintain an efficient and effective local delivery system. The importance of this really can't be stressed too much. They do the work of the state conservation and really all of our goals. So we need to make sure that they're healthy, that they have organizational capacity and technical capacity.
Representative Scully.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks so much for the presentation. And my question, I think, falls in this area, and so if it doesn't, guide me through the rest so that you can tell me when to bring it up. But it regards watershed management. The Office of the Legislative Auditor's Report, is this the proper place to bring up that question, would you think?
Sure.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was quite a good report. I thought it was January of 2007, and I've been looking it over quite carefully. And one of the recommendations was in there was that Board of Water and Soil Resources should establish performance and operational standards for local water management entities. So, in other words, establishing those standards and then providing oversight and to make sure that all of these things are happening appropriately. And I'm kind of wondering. I'm sure you've looked at this report as well, and I'm wondering how you are working toward the outcome of meeting those recommendations.
Ms. Clacker.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. We would love the opportunity to come and report on that as well in a more in-depth presentation. We were given some authority in order to have oversight and compliance to basically keep those LGUs accountable. And that program we're calling the Performance Review and Assistance Program, and it actually isn't really a program anymore. It's how Bowser does its work. It's part of everything that we do. And the example that I'm giving in this presentation, it will provide some of that information. We developed the overall program for how we will evaluate LGU performance last year, and we spent a lot of time with a group of LGU staff members and tried to figure out what kind of indicators, what kind of benchmarks, what kind of goals will be good check marks for accountability. How do we check in on what they're doing? So we spent a year trying to develop that, and then we implemented it kind of on a test case basis. And I'm going to go through one example of that in just a minute, if that's okay. Right. So goal two, again, is to maintain that effective and efficient local delivery system. We do this through comprehensive local water management planning. And this is really where our board conservationists work very in-depth with all of these local units of government, making sure that they are considering all different types of resource needs, resource issues, as they develop their local water management plans. And they engage local citizens in that process. We also have this performance review. We need to make sure that staff are adequately trained, not only on conservation, but also on how to perform as a good LGU. And part of the way that we support this is through our general services grant. The example that I have here is our performance review and assistance program. This was developed in 2007. The funding for this, we had a $100,000 a year per year for this biennium, and that actually is a portion of our cost share. It wasn't a separate funding line item or any kind of unique funding source. What we were allowed to do is take that off of the cost share dollars, $100,000 per year, in order to implement this. We did hire an expert in this, so we have one full-time employee that's paid by this, but it does take portions of all of our board conservationists as well as our regional supervisors and also central office staff. So there's portions of other people that work on it. An example indicator of the performance, there are many performance indicators under the PREP program, but one of them is the percent of LGUs with approved water management plans. Our target is 100%. The first time that we did this, we recognized that there were a number that weren't meeting that goal. Our 2008 outcome is 93% are meeting that goal, that requirement. But the really important indicator here is that we're working with 16 of the 18 to make sure that they are getting their local water management plans completed. So is that helpful? Do you have any other questions about that specifically?
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, it is.
Goal three is to evaluate the effectiveness and outcomes of our conservation programs. When we provide these grants, we can sometimes count widgets, you know, the number of things that we've actually put on the ground. But then what we need to come back and do is make sure that those widgets actually produce a measurable outcome in the environment. And these three items that we have on, under the supporting programs are really looking at not only what do the widgets produce as far as improvements in the environment, but we also look at how well did those LGUs perform on complying to the grant requirements. And then we need to get out into the field and actually do some ground truthing. What does it mean when these are adopted? Does it improve the soil? Does it improve the water resources? So we have three programs under here, and that's our eLink reporting program, and some of you are very familiar with that. It is it's quite a remarkable program in that it's how we manage our grants, and it's also how every practice that is used or implemented with those grant dollars is accounted for. We also have grant compliance and closeouts, and our board conservationists go out and they meet with every LGU and basically do an accounting, kind of a verification of how they spent those dollars and to make sure that they met the requirements of those grants. And then our landscape indicators, that's also a program that I believe that is important that we need to expand on. An example is a tillage transect survey and soil erosion surveys, which we haven't done, but we would very much like to, and we'd like to build on what Wisconsin's been doing with that program. The example that I have for you is our eLink reporting program. And this really reports on the efforts, the amount of projects that have been implemented through any of our grant programs, really. The indicators, one of the indicators could be the pounds of sediment prevented from entering surface water or sediment reduction. And the target, and it's important to remember that these are local units of government that have a plan, so the targets might be more tied to their local plan that we need to check in on how they're doing on meeting their local targets, but we can determine what the overall statewide impact is. And this example, 1.3 million tons per year, and that's for a five-year period. Goal number four is to improve the management of public drainage systems. The map that you see here, the red indicates that it is, those are channelized streams and ditches. When you see the amount of red on this map, you know that drainage management is incredibly important to water quality in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Lilly.
No.
Representative Wagini.
Thank you. Just backtracking for a minute. When you said that the outcome on the e-link was 1.3 million tons that didn't get into the waterways, what percentage of what gets into the waterways is that? I mean, it doesn't, I have no context here. Is that big? Is it small?
Karen, Representative Wagenius. That's a very good question. It's hard to, with a preventative indicator, what we know is what wouldn't have gone in. How much is going in? That's where we need to do some of that, the erosion surveys, some more of that field verification of what's happening on that landscape. I don't have a direct answer for you. I can work on trying to give you a good answer, but I don't have that right now.
That would be helpful.
Okay.
Because we don't know where we are.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
I think what you're trying to get at is, compared to what it could have been, how did we do against that?
Not really. Well, not so much that as if you're getting this much out of how much is actually getting in. It's a simpler thing than that, not how much better you could do, but how much is actually getting in and what portion are you keeping out.
Ms. Clark.
Thank you. We'll work on that. Back to goal four, the map really indicates the number of, the percentage of the area of the state that does have highly channelized drained areas. And that's why it is really important for us to work with drainage authorities on making sure that the management of these systems is done well, because it does have a direct impact on water quality in the state. We do have a number of programs that support this goal. We have a drainage work group, a drainage management team. We work on drainage records modernization to make sure that we aren't managing systems in 2009 with maps that are from 1908. We also develop guidance materials, and we now also have a reporting requirements. That's the example that I have for you today. In 2007, there was a new statute that was approved requiring reporting of buffer strips and the amount of activities that require that are implemented that require buffer strips. An example indicator of that is the percent of responses. I have two indicators for you. In 2007, we really used this as kind of a test, a pilot study of just to alert all of our drainage authorities that this is a requirement. The 2007 data, since the law was approved in May, I'm not sure how accurate or complete our data is, but we are really looking at it as a pilot and putting everybody on notice that this is a requirement certainly from now on. So we did have 79% response rate in 2007 activities. An example indicator of that is the number of miles of new ditch, our 2007 outcome is 203 miles. The report goes a little bit further, and I can provide more information. Representative Hansen, you're interested in that, the amount of activities that require those things. We are just now getting that data back. We sent our first request in September, a reminder in November, and we're trying to really compile that data now.
Ms. Clacker, so let's say that the 2008 data comes back and you still have a 79% response, and it's the same local governments who aren't responding, even with a no-activity response. Do they get wrapped into your PRAP program then, that they're not following the law and what they're required to respond?
Representative Hansen, that is that's a great question, and it will become part of our overall accountability checklist of things. Have you submitted your required paperwork? Have you required your required survey and inventory information? If they don't, that will be reported in our overall PRAP program, and they also will not be eligible for the grant funds.
Proceed.
Goal 5 is to ensure the long-term integrity of the state's investment. As you know, the state makes a tremendous amount of investment in our RIM program and also in our wetland banking program. We need to make sure that those are maintained and that what they went in as several years ago is what they still are. So this is really looking at our programs, our RIM service agreements that we have with our LGUs to go out and inspect those RIM easements. And then we also have a wetland bank monitoring program. And this has just really got, the wetland bank monitoring program is fairly new. We've been developing it and learning a lot of lessons from it as well. This map just indicates the amount of RIM reserve easements from 1986 to 2008. The example that I have for you is our RIM service agreement. So when we give the grants to the SWCDs to inspect these, they look at it not only from the amount of vegetation, invasive species, things like that, but they also ensure that the boundary integrity is kept in place, that there's not encroachment on that state easement. The funding for this program is $345,000 a year. It is down from several years ago where it was $750,000 a year. It equates to about $70 per easement. And there are 5,300 easements in the state, over 200,000 acres. And it does come from our general fund.
Ms. Clacker, on that, so we've lost money over time, or we've had a reduction in funding, which has caused you to go back and check on the easements at a slower rate.
Our inspection rate is still the same. Our indicator is that they're inspected once every year for the first 5 years, just to make sure that the install is going well and that the vegetation community has taken root. After that, then it's inspected once every 3 years. But I think the issue of the funding comes down to how much does it really cost to protect that state investment. When the SWCDs do find that there is a violation or that there's something that needs to take place, it requires follow-up on their part. They need to issue letters, work with the landowner, meet on site, and try to take care of that problem. I'm not sure that the funding level for this is enough to really cover that, but they are doing it because they believe in the effort.
Would it be fair to say that it's hard to manage the easements if you don't have them measured, if you're not out there measuring the border integrity and checking on them and keeping track of them?
Terry, yes, I believe that would be accurate. Goal 6 is to increase our technical knowledge and capacity, not only of us at Bowser, but also of our LGUs, and that we need to make sure that we are on top of changing resource trends and needs. Our supporting programs, we do have the State Soils Office, and we work at the University of Minnesota at that State Soils Office. We have an office right there. We work with them on soils data research projects, as well as having our Certified Wetland Delineator program. We also do research. We provide evaluation of BMP projects when they're implemented, and we conduct studies on larger scale projects. We provide technical training, and an important thing is when you look at research and studies, those are very, very expensive types of projects. We have a tremendous amount of skilled technical people out there that are doing great projects. One of the things we need to do is really build up this peer-to-peer network. We don't have enough money to do studies on every single project, so when we have people that are experienced on how these things work, we need to make sure that they can sit down peer-to-peer and say, you know what, this didn't work for me. Vegetation management is one of those things. It's a very unique type of situation. Every single project is unique. Learning from each other is a very good way to make sure that the implementation of those best management practices is done well and is sustainable. An example that we have, and this is for our State Soils Office, which is this project is currently funded by LCCMR. We need to make sure that there's accurate soils data out there and that it is available in a GIS format. The old books and paper don't work when you're trying to use GIS to develop programs and projects and target those in the best possible place. So we need to make sure that that data is available in a GIS format. This is funded at about $400,000 per year through the LCCMR. An example indicator of this is the availability of web-based data. Currently, there are 83 out of 91 areas that have been completed. A number of them are being worked on, but the effort will take time and will continue into the future. Goal 7 is to provide transparent accountability and communicator conservation performance. Some of the supporting programs and activities you see here are things that I've already talked about. Our E-Link program and our PREP program, those are things that we implement ourselves in order to make sure that we have accountability of our LGUs and that those conservation dollars are accounted for as well. What we need to do is make sure that we can put these into a more publicly accessible format. We'd like to develop a citizen query web-based system where they could look at what's happening in their area, not only from the conservation practices that are going on through PREP, but also or through E-Link, but also how are we doing on the PREP program. The reports are available.
Okay. Then it's all done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it sounds like you're really working toward where I was headed with the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report. And I'm wondering, as you're going through this now, you're talking about releasing public assessments of their performance, how do we reach the people to report to, other than on the web? Is there another mechanism that we use, local newspapers? Is there any way that we can inform the residents of the local community in a more easily accessible fashion for some people who may not have computers.
Ms. Clagger.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. I believe that there is a way. Have we designed a way yet? No, we haven't. But those are the things that we would like to be able to make more concerted efforts in. When we have projects, good things that happen also, we need to be better at that. We need to make sure that local citizens are aware of how their taxpayer dollars are being used and that that those LGUs are high-performing. And we need to be able to communicate that better. These two web-based, query-based, inquiry-based programs allow that to happen easily throughout the state, but you're absolutely right. Those those pieces of information need to get out locally. We haven't designed a plan for that yet, but it's clearly one of our major goals. And in fact, out of all of these goals that we have, goal 1, 2, and 7 are the fundamentals of our strategic plan. We believe in communicating on our results, not only of the conservation efforts, but the LVU performance.
Ms. Clacker.
The third thing there is the website, the web reporting requirements. This is a screenshot of our e-link program, which just in this last 6 months, we have now launched it as a web. It used to be more of a login kind of a interface through their own computer. Now it's web-based, so anybody anywhere could go in and really use this, but it is only usable right now by our LGUs and staff. But our website reporting requirements, that was required in legislation in 2007, required all SWCDs to have websites. There was a small amount of funding that was made available in order to incent them to do this. Our indicator is the number of SWCDs that meet those reporting requirements. Not only are they required to have a website, but there are a number of different types of pieces of information that are required to be on that website regularly. Our target, obviously, is 100% compliance. Our outcome is 90 out of 91 have met those requirements.
Ms. Clacker, would we have 90 out of 91 districts with a website if we hadn't required them to do it?
Most likely not. It's a very good program. It was a very good way to incent that to happen.
Thanks.
So just a review of our 2008-2009 our current biennial budget. Our general fund, including Clean Water Legacy, is $49.7 million. That's about 76% of our budget. So we do have a tremendous amount of our budget that is general funds. Our Environmental Trust Fund, LCCMR, we have about $2.6 million. We had an allocation for the Southeast Flood. Many of you know Bowser was very active in going down there and trying to assist on the conservation efforts down in the Southeast area. And we also have some other revenue and federal funding like APUB that comes through us. So our total budget is $65.2 million. Our revenue sources, this is just another look at that, easier to look at picture. Our expenditures by category, agency operations is about 15% of our overall expenditures. Obviously, the majority of what we do, and that is reflected in our small agency and our large local delivery system, is that 85% of our funding goes out to that local delivery system. Our expenditures, and this is our operating budget. This is just a breakdown of salaries, how we spend everything other than salaries, travel, rent, things like that. So that's just to give you a snapshot. Obviously, the majority, like many other agencies that are going to report, goes into salary and benefits. Overall, our grants, how we distribute them, this is the breakdown of the different types of grants that we have. Our Natural Resource Block Grant, which goes out for doing activities like the Wetland Conservation Act and implementing that locally. Our SWCD Service Grant, which is basically maintaining the state's effort out in the local community. Cost Share, Clean Water Legacy, those are doing those DMP projects. WACA, we have some unique funding in order to work on reporting and enforcement. We did have drainage grants this year also in order to update those records. LCCMR grants, our Southeast Flood, and then we also have, again, that ACUB and other federal funding. And that is an overview of our 2008-2009 biennial budget and how we are working to address the budgeting for results. And I'd be happy to take any questions.
Representative Wagini.
Thank you. I understand that you don't have your reports in things like, I'm looking under goal one of length of shoreline restored. I'm more interested in, right this minute, on to what level do we restore a shoreline when we do it? And the reason I'm asking this question is, we are seeing water come from whatever reason, whether it's heavier rainfall, at higher intensity. So what performance base do you put out there for this shoreline shall be restored? Well, of course, that's shoreline. I was thinking of a stream, but this may not be a stream, but you probably do have stream shoreline.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, where it is a drainage, what level and how do you determine that?
Good question.
Karen, Representative Lagunias, the technical requirements for how those are installed, there is a whole technical guidebook. And that technical guidebook is developed through a lot of expertise at NRCS, us, U of M, others, which gives guidelines of how things need to be designed based on slope, length, the stream characteristics, lake characteristics, waves, different things like that. So each one is individual, but there are standards that are established that if you're going to implement a project, you need to look at that unique site characteristic and design it to that characteristic.
Representative Lagunias.
But unless those characteristics have been updated to the additional volume and intensity of water, then they're probably too old for what's really happening in the ground and much too old for what we expect because, I mean, all the predictions of climate change say water is going to come faster, more compactly. So how do we not design for what happened in the past, but design for what we anticipate?
Ms. Clark.
Chair and Representative Lagunias, I understand your question, and I definitely know that hydrology is changing, and certainly we're going to be faced with even more changing hydrology in the future. The design standards, having been an implementer of those myself, I think are very well designed. They're updated regularly. The hydrology data, as you know, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency is doing a update to rain frequency, duration, intensity right now, and that information will be very helpful in order to update any of that information, those technical standards. But the other piece that's very important is that peer-to-peer network. You know, we have some amazingly experienced technical staff out there who can help each other really understand those changing needs and design to meet those. When you put in it at shorelines, and I did my first shoreline restoration in 1998, and it was a failure because we didn't understand at that point some of the mechanisms about that, and we learned over time, and we had to go back to that site several times in order to figure it out because of the effects of the waves, you know, on that lake. We didn't quite understand that. The research component of that will be slower than that peer-to-peer network sitting down with our other technical people that are installing those and saying, you know what, that's not going to work and here's why. That's going to be actually a much more rapid way to get that information out.
Representative Lagunias.
Okay, I can understand that, but it seems to me that we need to give some direction that says we don't want you to design for yesterday or today or even next year. I mean, how long are you expecting these things to last? And, I mean, how long are you expecting them to last? I don't know.
Ms. Clagger.
Thank you, Karen. Representative Lagunias. On the cost share, the agreement is that it must be maintained for at least 10 years, and we have site inspections on that to make sure that that is maintained for at least 10 years. Obviously the RIM projects and the banking projects are permanent, but we do try to make sure that we go out there, inspect the sites, make sure that they are being maintained, that there isn't any failure of the critical components that we put in there.
Representative Lagunias.
I mean, I think this is when we're investing state dollars, So for a stream bank, it's only 10 years that we have. That's all we're asking.
Chair and Representative Virginia, that's what our cost share agreements require. Obviously, we're designing them for long-term permanent install. But as far as our agreement with the landowner, and when we believe that there is a, after 10 years, we believe that there is a good chance, you know, if it's been maintained at that point, it's probably going to be okay. So we go out and look at that for 10 years. But at that point, it is believed that it's installed and it's functioning well. And we don't check up on that after that because that's deemed to be an appropriate time for that project to be self-sustaining.
I mean, I think maybe this committee needs to discuss when we are investing this money, is 10 years good enough, and is a design standard that isn't taking into account what folks are expecting in 20 or 30 years good enough. So, I mean, I think that's something that the committee should
Ms. Clacker.
Chair and Representative Virginia, I think that you're right on in that we need to make sure that there is good research, and maybe some of the things that it comes down to is we go out and we inspect some of those projects that have been in for a significant amount of time to see what's happened with them. You know, this program has been in place for several decades now, and that might be a good way to look at the overall performance of that investment, and that would be certainly something that we would love to be able to consider.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. Wouldn't you also say that as you raise the standards and the requirements for the quality of the installation, that we would be able to do less installations and have an impact on fewer acres because of the higher cost? Ms. Clacker.
Chair and Representative Torkelson, there is a point where you over-design and you over-install. Some practices, you know, are quite simple, and if it's a grass waterway, maybe that doesn't need the same kind of technical review or development as something like a stream bank in a hydrologically rigid regimen, and so there are some that maybe are okay to not have that level of performance review or expectations. There are others that we probably do need to stay on top of with changing hydrology, changing environment and needs.
Thank you, Chair. Certainly, you know, we want to get the best bang for our bucks across the state of Minnesota. That includes not only quality but also quantity, and it's a balancing act, and evaluation of what we've done in the past and how those projects are working today certainly is an important endeavor, and I applaud your efforts to do that.
Thank you.
Ms. Clacker, I have a question on some specific appropriations that we did to you last session. One was, and I'd like you to see if the expenditures have been completed and if the projects are done. One was the Star Lake Board.
Representative Hansen, Chair Hansen, the Star Lake Board, that was my specific responsibility. The appropriation, it's been encumbered. I don't believe that they've requested those funds. I believe they will at the February 12th meeting. The reason is they needed to establish themselves as a nonprofit first. And they have filled out all that paperwork. They believe that they're going to get their approval for that before the end of February, and then they want to request those funds and be a legal entity that has their own, obviously as a 501c3, you have your own auditing requirements, your own bookkeeping requirements, and they wanted to wait for that until that was done. So it has been encumbered, but the request has not been made by them.
The second was relating to WACA. I think we provided enforcement dollars, and with a portion of those being transferred DNR. What's happened with that?
Chair Hansen, the appropriation was made for, and that was for, are you speaking specifically about the flyovers or the metro area, the flyovers? So the flyovers happened last year in a number of areas of the state. They generated a lot of local, activity. So what the appropriation went out, the DNR did do the flyovers. What we want to do, it worked as far as generating a lot of activity. What we'd like to do in the future is have better coordination efforts with that so that the LGUs that are going to be getting the calls about the enforcement are really tuned into when the DNR is coming so that they can anticipate a workload. We did see an increased workload because of those flyovers and inspections.
And the third was the grants to the you to give to use as work with the Minnesota Conservation Corps. And I think some of that work was done in southeastern Minnesota. Could you elaborate on that and how that worked?
Chair Hansen, I don't have any of the specifics, but I do have the report from MCC that I could make available to you. Our relationship with MCC, I think, was a very good, very strong relationship. They were very responsive. When the Southeast flood happened and we needed them to get down there, they got down there. When they worked with our LGUs to implement some of the Clean Water Legacy projects, they were very attentive to the LGU's needs. They worked very well. They were highly accountable to us, reporting to us on their activities. Overall, I would say it was a very great relationship with high accountability and great results.
Any other questions? Representative Wagenius.
If nobody else has a question. When I'm looking back at your next to the last pie chart, or your last pie chart, and the 23% and the 12% for best management practices projects, how many of those best management practices have actually been tested to see so the results for water quality have been evaluated?
Ms. Clacker.
You may not know that, but I think that would be helpful to know for the future.
Chair Hansen, Representative Virginia, I believe if you're looking at the 23% that is for the Clean Water Legacy, and then there's also the other cost share grants and other things like that. All of the practices that we allow through our program are based on science. Those are the technical standards that have been developed. So they are based on science. As far as the overall impact, we have case studies of individual projects, larger landscape projects that can talk about the impact on water quality. But we certainly can't do that everywhere, but those studies are what base the technical standards. As far as what happens as far as each one improving the water quality of that specific water body that they're meant to affect, I believe that that's a long-term partnership that we will have with our sister agency, the MPCA, about what's happening in that water column, what's happening in the stream, what's happening in the lake. So what we try to do is look at that specific project, what did it do on site as far as reduction of phosphorus, reduction of soil erosion, and then we need to pair up those data with what happens in a stream, maybe in a couple of years, in a lake, possibly generational change.
Representative Wagenius, follow up.
Final thing. The reason I'm asking about this is Governor Carlson said that he wanted to clean up the Minnesota River in 10 years. And good for him. And PCA did a baseline study, I believe it was in 1994, and looked at the biology of the river, which is the correct way to figure out what's going on. And then we did a follow-up, a partial follow-up, in 2004. And PCA reports there was no change in the biology of the river. And we all know we spent hundreds of millions of dollars in that watershed. Mm-hmm. We don't know how much, but we'll we'll figure that out. So we thought we were doing all best management practices. So what happened?
Ms. Clark.
Terry Hansen, Representative Virginia. As far as the Minnesota River, I can't tell you specifically what happened there, but I can talk in some generalizations from my experiences. The types of practices that we do that prevent erosion, that prevent sediment from going into the water body, be it a lake or stream, they're able to address those immediate issues. There are obviously changing land use, population growth, change in impervious surface, change in hydrology, and if maybe time stood still and all we were able to do is go pack up and fill up all those things that weren't working well, maybe there might have been more change. But there is change in everything that we do and ecology. And the other thing that's very important to, as far as biota, you can make significant reductions in pollutant loading to any water body, but the time that you get your biota to change from a worm to a mayfly is tremendous. You know, when I worked on the Sauk River chain of lakes, we decreased over 30 years, we being PCA, Bowser, SWC, you name it, decreased phosphorus by 50%. It went from 300 parts per billion down to 150 parts per billion on average. In order to get a good mayfly hatch, we need to get it to 70. So it took us 30 years to get it in half. We aren't to the point where we're going to have good biota. It doesn't mean that there's not good things happening, but the biota response is just a lot more intensive in the amount of particles, pollution that you can have in there. So 10 years is a short period of time for a landscape.
Representative McGinnis, I have two other questions from other members, so I'd like to go to Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And according to the LARS and E-Link reporting by the Clean Water Partnership in Section 319, Project Partners, Representative McGinnis, over the last 10 years, the number of best management practices has been 2,783. The results on estimated soil loss reduction has been about 160,000 tons per year. The estimated sediment reduction has been 60,000 tons per year, and the estimated phosphorus reduction has been 241,000 pounds per year. So we are seeing some results.
Ms. Clark, do you have Representative Purcell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just you kind of got to my the point I was going to try and make here when you were finishing up, and that is that 10 years is unrealistic. I think well-intended, but unrealistic. In my experience of 30 years in water quality, it's going to take at least as long to clean it up as it took to get it that way. So it's decades, you know, decades and decades. So.
Ms. Packer, any final words?
I just thank you for the opportunity to come here and discuss. I mean, this is great information. It's a great dialogue, and we look forward to continuing to work with you on making sure that we're meeting the goals of the state. So, thank you.
Thank you. I believe we do have a quorum. Representative Dill, have you looked over the minutes?
I did.
Would you like to move the minutes? Representative Dill moves the minutes from the 29th. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Minutes are approved. We do have a bill on the agenda, and Chair Wagenius will be taking back the gavel.
So
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 18 to pass and have it referred to the Finance Committee to be referred to the Cultural and Outdoors Committee.
It will be, I think the correct motion would be to re-refer it to the Cultural and Outdoors Heritage Committee. Do you want to make that motion?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Does it go through Finance first to go back there?
Finance to Cultural.
To Finance with the
recommendation.
Right. Okay. We've got it.
House File 18, the reason you're here for the first bill of this for in front of this committee is on November 4th, the voters of Minnesota approved the constitutional amendment to dedicate dollars to four funds. One of those funds, also we had statutes last session to create the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council. But in that statute, we did not appropriate funds for the council because we did not know that whether or not the constitution amendment would pass. And so the council had its first meeting on December 1st. I have with me Chair Mike Kilgore of the council. The DNR has had staff that has been working on the council. We have had members who are coming into meetings. We have been expending dollars. And the reason we have this bill here is to appropriate funds. So we're meeting our responsibilities to have an appropriation for expenditures for the council for the rest of this year, and then until some of the sales tax dollars come in. The sales tax revenue will not be started to be collected until July 1st of 2009. We will not start to see receipts until August 15th at the earliest. So from now until then, we do not have an appropriation. We have work being done for the council, and therefore we have House File 18 in front of you. I do have an author's amendment that I believe has been passed out, and I would like to move the DE3 amendment to get the bill into the shape I'd like it to be in. The amendment, I can move that.
Yes, if you'd move the amendment.
I'd like to move the DE3 amendment.
The author moves the DE3 amendment to get the bill in the shape that he would like that. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The DE3, the bill as amended with DE3 has language that was approved in the Senate Commissioner Meyer is here who can describe that language. In addition, we put dates in there for clarity. November 15th, 2008 was the date when the canvassing board certified the election results. So we are saying from November 15th on, going back and looking at the dollars that the DNR has expended from that time, and then through October 1st, 2009. So that gives time for the expenditures to occur for the council until we are sure we have dollars that can be used to reimburse the funds from the sales tax revenue. So at the end of the day, we should be using sales tax revenue for the administrative costs, but right now we need to have the appropriations to account for that. I have with me Mr. Kilgore, and he has some testimony he would like to provide.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mike Kilgore. During my day job, I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota in the Department of Forest Resources, and I was appointed to serve on the Outdoor Heritage Council and asked to chair it. We also, just for your information, we do have four members of the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council here today, Representative Gunther, Representative Hansen, Bob Schroeder, and I am I missing one person? And myself, I guess.
Yes,
that's right. Couple things. One is the legislation that created the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council set us up within the legislative branch of government, yet the administration of that council is defined in Chapter 97A as being the Department of Natural Resources. This bill would move the administration to be consistent with the legislative branch of government. So that's one thing. Secondly, it would allow us then to be able to move forward and to begin hiring an executive director and an administrative person at least. We are very grateful that the Department of Natural Resources has provided us some interim staff. Bill Becker has been doing a very nice job. We have been meeting every other week. We have a couple of committees that are being established, so we are in desperate need of getting some of our own staff so that we can move forward. The Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council did meet a week ago Monday, took this issue up. It was discussed. The bill that's before you prior to the amendments was discussed, and I just want to let you know that the Outdoor Heritage Council is unanimous in its support for this bill.
Yes, Representative Ann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's Kilgore?
Yes.
Mr. Kilgore, it was my understanding that the DNR was responsible for any administrative needs for the council with the effort of making sure that the bulk of the funds would be going towards its intended purpose. So I guess I'm just kind of confused, and maybe Representative Hansen can speak more to that. That was my understanding last year when this went through. It was the legislative intent that the DNR would assume these costs so that we could save the money that was generated through the sales tax for clean water, heritage, and so forth.
Madam Chair and Representative, you're correct in that the statute that creates the council does indicate that the Department of Natural Resources is to provide the administrative support to the council. It does not say that they are to finance those activities. That same body of law says that up to 1% of the Outdoor Heritage Fund can be used for administrative costs, including salary of staff as well as travel and other related expenses of council members. So it does say that the department is responsible for the administration, but does not state that they are responsible for providing the financial support for that administration.
Yes, Representative Ratner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure if my questions are for the author, Mr. Kilgore, Commissioner Meyer. Mr. Kilgore, I think everything is in Subdivision 2, Chapter H, and for the members, I'll read it. The Department of Natural Resources shall provide administrative support for the council. Up to 1% of the money appropriated from the fund may be used to cover the staffing and related administrative expenses of the department to cover the compensation and travel expense of council members. I see nowhere in that paragraph that any money should have been spent so far that with any obligation perceived by anybody. The department is supposed to administer support of the council. I don't think, has any money been spent already? Has there been per diem paid? And under what authority has per diem been paid?
Madam Chair, members of the record, Bob Myers, Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. To date, the expenditures that were allocated or we're tracking right now include staffing costs of approximately $12,000. There's parking costs for every meeting that occurs here in the state office building. We're providing, the DNR is providing parking over the AA lot, so there's a cost for those cards. There's copying, there's photo, or there's mailing costs, there's reimbursements. We have currently $2,500 of mileage and lodging and meal reimbursements that we're reviewing and we'll be paying out as soon as those are all thoroughly checked and approved. So there are costs that are being incurred right now. Commissioner Holston has sent a letter to the council and also the finance chairs in both the House and the Senate stating that we've set aside or we've allotted $100,000 from the Game and Fish Fund to provide the support for these activities. And in our conversations with the council, it's their intent to reimburse or repay those dollars back to the department, which we'll put back into an account within the Game and Fish Fund that we have the authority to spend on these types of activities. The intent, I think, of the council members is to have these costs covered through an appropriation in their bill, much like the administrative costs that are incurred through the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources. As Chair Kilgore stated, there is language that allows for up to 1% of the appropriation to be spent on administrative costs. So those costs would cover the training or the travel, lodging, meals, and the cost of running the committee. Much like this committee has an annual budget, the council will be establishing an annual budget, but because the legislature required the DNR to provide the administrative support without an appropriation, We needed to spend some dollars to get it up and running, and we're keeping very close tabs on those costs and working with the council so they understand what those costs are. I think the language that Representative Hansen here has here is to provide some base level of funding to the Legislative Coordinating Commission to do these costs. So we can talk about where we're at, what we're paying for, and how it should be done, but that's the intent of the language, I think. And there's a few tweaks that we need to work with Representative Hansen on as we move forward with the language, just to make sure the costs that we have incurred are not only reimbursed, but also reappropriated, so we can spend those dollars as they were supposed to be spent for on the licensing activities in the Game and Fish Fund.
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, the bill required that the council start on December 1st, so that was the first meeting, and the council's been meeting to get the process going so that recommendations can be made back to the legislature by April 1st. The bill did not appropriate money. I think the key word is their appropriation. That's why you have this early introduction bill that provides the appropriations, so the legislature is appropriating money for the council to expend.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Meyer, what percentage of the DNR budget is the administration? You have stuff doesn't come out of the general fund. You have, we just heard Bowser, and it was 15%. You have an administrative division. You work for it, and not everything is comes out of a fund, right? What part of your budget, the DNR budget, is the administration, just a rough percentage?
Madam Chair, members, we covered some of these numbers the other night, and I'm going to try to do my best to recite some of those numbers. Approximately for our operation management and budget services, it's about $30 million, with over half of that going to grants. I think the direct administrative cost, including regional ops, is about $11 million or so. But those are, that's just from a variety of different funds as well. So
what my point is, Commissioner, you are directed in statute. Again, this is the case. We spent money that we shouldn't be spending. The people shouldn't have been promised per diem that are on it, and at least to be paid before July 1st. This fund doesn't get any money until July 1st. It says the department shall provide administrative support for the council. We're not supposed to rob it out of the Game and Fish Fund and be paying people ahead of time. This thing was set up that 1% of the money could be appropriated from the fund, maybe used to cover staffing and related administrative expenses of the department, to cover compensation and travel expenses of council members. The council shouldn't have been spending money, and their checks shouldn't have been cut to these folks yet. We should be waiting until August 1st or July 1st, or August 15th, whenever you're going to get the money. Then if you want to talk about paying them retroactively out of the 1%, that would be fine. And I don't see anywhere in here where it talks about hiring staff now. You don't have any money until July 1st. We should not be spending money we don't have. This is not right, Madam Chair. This is not right.
Representative Portman. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Meyer, are there some parameters or guidelines in writing about the lodging and the meals expenses? I could see that as being a real sore point with taxpayers if there's not some sort of parameter spelled out.
Madam Chair, Representative, first of all, let me just go back to the comment Representative McNamara made. We are keeping very close track of this. We haven't hired anybody. The DNR has appointed Bill Becker, who works very closely with us with the LCCMR. I refer to him as an ex officio DNR employee right now, because he is assigned to the council as their director. He's not doing any other DNR work. We're tracking his costs, and we're going to be seeking reimbursement for those costs. As far as the per diem, it is following the guidelines that Department of Administration lays out, that every other member of any council that they participate in gets reimbursed for. The mileage rates are the same as any other, per rates are the same as any other person. If you want to think of a similarity, it's the same way that the citizens on the LCCMR are reimbursed and eligible costs are being paid for. So it is in statute, I believe in Chapter 15, how those costs are being tracked and what is allowable and what's not allowable. And they are itemized using state forms, and it is in the statute, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Mr. Meyer, that doesn't really answer my question. Is there some sort of a parameter on lodging or meals so we make sure we're not buying steaks at Manny's or accommodations at the Hilton when people could be staying at the Kitchen?
Madam Chair, there is a limit Representative Portman, I can get, we can provide that, that people's detailed information. I believe they may receive, and again, if you look in, and I can't find it right now, 978.056, which outlines the authority of the council. I can get that straight to you in a second here. But it does provide for, I believe, probably $50 a day for members for the meetings. The standard reimbursement for mileages, last time I checked, was like 41 cents. It's the IRS, federal mileage parameters. I believe the dinner is the same way. It's probably $15 maximum for dinners. And then the lodging, we try to look for the best rates. I mean, they aren't staying at the downtown Hilton or anything like that. I would assume most of them are probably staying at the Kellyanne, just like a lot of people who come down here.
Madam Chair, Representative Portman, to follow up on that, part of the challenge we have with the council is it's a hybrid between the legislative branch and the executive branch. And the model looking at the LCCMR, which is in the legislative branch, because those are legislative entities, the legislator is going to have to sign off on the travel authorization. So there has to be review beyond staff or beyond the DNR for reviewing those authorizations. And that's probably going to be my responsibility. I'm on the executive committee as a legislative member and the role of looking over those things, just as I do when I'm chair of the audit commission, looking over mileage, double-checking, so that there is legislative approval of those expenses of the citizen members.
Are we
going to
deal with
this?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, if I remember, this happened to be the bill that I authored, and we spent a month negotiating this bill with Senator Chaudhry, a number of us. And Section H, I think Representative McNamara already said it, the Department of Natural Resources shall provide administrative support to the council. 1% of the money is appropriated fund may be used to cover the staffing and related administrative expenses of the department. But yet I hear here at this table that we're going to hire an executive director and a bunch of staff, and we never even talked about that. Never once do I recall from my memory that we talked about anything other than the department. In fact, it says it very plainly in the, this isn't particularly on the bill, this is after I've listened to everyone talking, I feel like it's a runaway horse already. And I can tell you that as the chair of the conference committee, I never intended that this organization would look like LCCMR. Not once. In fact, we tried to design it so it didn't look like that, and it didn't operate like that. And at least in my mind, I was. I don't know what Senator Chaudhry, he has his own promises that he makes. And so I'm less concerned about the money that we, it just makes sense that if citizens are going to come, they ought to get paid per diem and mileage and their expenses. And some way we got to figure out a mechanism to get this done. But this idea of another bureaucracy, another bunch of staff, do you get it? We don't have any money. What part of that, I sound like I'm talking to my kids. We don't have any money. So why did I hear we're hiring an executive director when it says right here, very plainly, to cover the staffing and related administrative expenses of the department?
Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Meyer, I guess I would feel more comfortable if you gave us an itemization, basically, of what this money is going to be going for. Because I started doing the numbers here. Over an 11-month period, we're doling out over $13,000 per month. What does that cover? What are we talking about here? That's over $1,000 per person that serves on the board. And I guess I think in light of what we are experiencing right now, the chair has expressed wanting to have outcomes and looking at what the results are and having a good, clear idea of what the money is buying. I think that would be really helpful for us before we move ahead with something like that. And if you could provide that, that would be really helpful.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I think the request probably should go to the council itself. The council isn't a part of the DNR. The council was established in statute. All we're doing, we were required by statute to provide administrative support. We've taken our personnel and loaned them to the council, basically, because the council wants to hire their own staff. We weren't really consulted in the crafting of this statute at all, but we're doing our best that we can to make sure that the council gets up and running successfully. So with that in mind, Commissioner Holston has said, okay, there was no appropriation, but we'll find $100,000 for the biennium for 2009 is what he communicated to the legislature to get the council up and running. The council has taken upon itself, this is not a DNR bill, this is a bill the council has asked to introduce. They're seeking to get funding from the water rec account to fund their operations so that they can hire, the council can hire its own executive director and whatever staff they determine they need. It's not a function of the DNR. So while I understand your concerns completely, I think it would be best if it's directed towards the council rather than the DNR, because they're the ones who will establish the budget and are seeking to spend these dollars.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I think maybe to help out in terms of what the expenditures are, when the council had its first meeting on December 1st, you had DNR staff that were preparing for that meeting. These are staff that have another job, so they start cost coding. We've made a strong pitch that they cost code their time as we've gone through other issues with the DNR. As the council gears up and has more frequent meetings and is working on preparing stuff, you have more staff time being expended by the DNR. Over the next 2 months, you'll see the council every other Monday here in this building going through the recommendation process. So we have an acceleration in the number of meetings trying to reach that recommendation deadline. The bulk of the costs that are going to come in are those DNR expenditures as staff are being used, preparing for those meetings, going day in, day out, every hour, and clocking that time towards the council. In terms of the members, there are members from all over Minnesota. When there are meetings on Monday mornings to get all the members here, you have some members that are driving in and they're staying at the Kelly Inn if they're coming in 4 or 5 hours. So the expenditures of reimbursement for their expenses, I think if you looked at the total picture, is probably a smaller amount, and that should be transparent as well in terms of the expenditure. So when we look at between December 1st, and the reason we have November 15th in here is that there was preparation by the DNR staff. There was expenses that were incurred prior to that, preparing for that December 1st meeting. They actually probably had expenditures before November 15th, but the results of the election were not certified until November 15th. I think that we can get, or we should be able to project, looking at the number of meetings and the staff time that's occurred, recognizing that in December, with the holidays, you have a ramp-up of time and holiday in there, getting to January, and now there's a very aggressive meeting schedule to see what the hours are spent by the DNR staff and the reimbursement requests that are coming or projected to be there from the council members.
Representative Anderson. Madam Chair, Representative Hanson, I don't argue with, you know, compensating people for their travel and so forth. That's fine with me. But I do think that we need to have some accountability measures in place. I think we owe it to the citizens, especially those who voted for this in particular, thinking that, you know, this money is going to be going towards outdoor preservation and cultural heritage and so forth. So that's what I'm looking for, that itemization. I recognize that the DNR staff are probably the ones that are going to be putting together. I'd like that the DNR assume those costs and that it not be lumped into more of this $150,000. But I would like to see exactly what are we talking about here. So I'm making that formal request, if I could.
The next person is Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In this whole discussion, I think it's knowing what we're spending our state money on and all of that, and having that laid out and the outcomes, I think is really good. But I also think we need to realize that government costs money, administration costs money. We have asked and citizens to bring their expertise, much of which we as legislators don't have. I'm not a forestry professor who has that background. and we've asked them to serve our state in that way. So I do think we need to be thinking about this in that context, and not that we're throwing money around at it, but that we are realizing that good government has a cost to it. And I think we've seen in some of our agencies, when they don't have things like internal auditors and some of those internal controls, our Office of the Legislative Auditor has shown us example after example after example, with their own Office of Management and Budget until very recently, not having a single auditor on their staff. And frankly, I'm looking at this and thinking, our citizens passed this constitutional amendment, and I don't want the DNR to be paying for that function that we've now got in our government completely. And so they've already extended staff time, they've already extended the cost of administration. And my question is, without this bill, would that DNR cost be paid back by the Outdoor Heritage Council? And it seems to me that this is, at least we know how much is going in and going out, and I'd like to know how much the Outdoor Heritage Council and what they're spending it on, but this seems like a very transparent way of the DNR making sure that they're not expending DNR monies that we are, as a finance committee, using on other things. And so my question, the simple one, is without this, would what the cost of DNR has incurred and will continue to occur be paid back? And how would that happen if this bill doesn't go forward?
The commissioner of DNR has provided a letter where he believes that there can be some funds that are moved back and forth under his authority. This is a legislative commission, and so it has that hybrid relationship where there's direction in statute and there's authority in the DNR. By passing this bill, we are providing the legislative authority and appropriation for this to happen. It's transparent. It's out in the open. You will vote on it here. If it passes, you'll vote on it again. So it's clear that authority is there. The expenditure of dollars without appropriation, I think, is a question that we want to make sure we're not doing. We want to appropriate the dollars for their intended purpose. Now, Representative Dill raises a point. If he doesn't think there should be expenditures for this amount or for this purpose as the legislative branch and a legislative commission, and with legislative appropriation, we hold the power of the purse.
Let me observe here to members that I have a list this long of people who want to testify, and I see the clock. And I suspect that there are important questions for members here. I know that there are people in the audience that want to testify. So I am going to lay this bill over until the Tuesday meeting. But before I do that and call for an adjournment, I'd like Mr. Kilgore to come up again, if he would. I think we all know, as we set the stage for what is going to happen in the future, that the citizens were enthusiastic about the constitutional amendment. It passed with a good vote. Tell us how you and the Heritage Council are engaging citizens in your process right now.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, you're absolutely right. The citizens expect us to deliver on this promise of better conservation and habitat practices. With the interim staff of Bill Becker that we have, we've created a website. We have all of our information about our meetings on the website. We have we have a distribution list of several hundred people. We are, as Representative Hansen mentioned, the Chapter 97A that establishes us, requires us to present our first recommendations on nearly $80 million of appropriations from the Outdoor Heritage Fund by April 1st of this year, in under 2 months. To do that, we've been working with a number of our conservation partners, public and nonprofit, private. We've asked them to work with us. They have enthusiastically been helping them. As part of that process, we've asked them to be inclusive in their process. We have asked them to engage anyone who is interested in working in the area of restoration, protection, enhancement of prairies, wetlands, forests, fish, game, wildlife habitat to help us in identifying those highest priority proposals. As part of that, they have sent out announcements to, for example, on the wetlands. There's a wetlands collaborative that is being put together that will be bringing us proposals for the highest priority wetland project on Monday. As the convener of that process, he let me know yesterday that they have not only personally contacted a number of the NGOs, state, federal, local governments, others, they have sent out a distribution list to over 700 people, encouraging them to participate. As I think many of you know, that there have been articles written in the St. Paul and the Minneapolis paper, one specifically about the wetland Chris Niskanen wrote, and at the end provided a contact information and an email for those who are interested in participating in that one. Our listserv for the Outdoor Heritage Council, I don't have the exact numbers, Madam Chair, but it's in the hundreds. We provide an opportunity at every council meeting, just an open opportunity for public comment, and we certainly encourage anyone who has an idea or a project or a proposal, they're welcome to present those. We're going to be, as Representative Hansen mentioned, starting Monday, we're going to be hearing the wetlands and the prairie proposals, and then on the 23rd of February, we're going to be hearing the forest, fish, game, and habitat proposal. We're on a very aggressive schedule because our by law, our bill needs to be to you by April 1.
My question was not how we are engaging interest groups. My question was how we were engaging citizens. And I am left with a concern that you have engaged interest groups and they are talking to their friends, but I don't see an engagement of Minnesotans. Millions of people voted for this, I suspect, if I my numbers right off the top of my head. So to have a listserv of 100 in the hundreds and have a website does not seem to engage the folks who actually voted on this. So let me just ask one other question. When you have these interest group meetings, is that widely posted, or how does the public know that they can come?
Madam Chair.
Not friends, but the public.
If I gave you and the committee the impression that this was inside baseball driven by just a select few folks, stakeholders, that was mistaken. That's not the case. Certainly they're involved. The Department of Natural Resources, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, Federal Fish and Wildlife Service, local units of government. But I can tell you that there are citizens also involved in that process. Just to respond to your question about how are we engaging the citizens, we at the Board of Water and Soil Resources, for example, held on our behalf 7 listening sessions around the state in November and December and presented the results of those findings. That's one example of trying to get that public input that we're seeking from not one select group, but anywhere. We have opportunities, as I mentioned, on our website, and we get reports about once every 3 or 4 days where people can provide comments, suggestions, advice, proposals to the council, and that comes from anyone. So if I gave you the impression that this is driven by a select group of folks, that's certainly not the case. And from the proposals that I've seen coming in from, for example, the Prairie collaborative proposal that came in yesterday to our council and we heard on Monday, there are 22 different elements to that, and there are all the way from public agencies, nonprofits, to individuals who will be making presentations and proposals. So it's not limited to just a select few.
Well, when you give me the input that we have a website, I don't know that anybody in my district would know about the website. I don't know how they would know. And I don't know how anybody in Representative Lilly's district would know or even in your district would know.
Madam Chair, excuse me, if I may just on that point, just recall we did send out a press release as well a couple of weeks ago describing the process. This was widely distributed. We didn't. The Department of Natural Resources on our behalf did to all the outstate papers explaining the process we're involved in, what we're trying to do, and how to get involved. So just as another example of our attempt to reach out as widely as we can.
Thank you. When you said you sent to outstate papers, did you send to the little metropolitan newspapers? We have scads of them.
Madam Chair, I don't know exactly who the Department of Natural Resources in their whatever division it is sent it out, but they assured me that it was their very extensive list of media contacts.
But let's find out before the next meeting, because we are, I am respectful of your time, yours, but I didn't want you to have to necessarily come back. But I do see the time here.
Madam Chair, if I could just give the website for members so that they can maybe send it out to folks in their district. LOHC.state.mn.us. LOHC.state.mn.us.
All right. Members, we meet on Tuesday. We will begin by taking up this bill again, to be fair to everybody, because I was not able to get down the list. We will then hear from PCA about their outcome. That meeting will, if they don't finish, and if we have lots of questions, we'll go into the evening. This is our letting Minnesotans know what their tax dollars purchase. So with that, the meeting is closed.